It's the Mike Tech Show, show number 470. This show is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Please visit techpodcast.com. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, Mike Smith. Thank you very much for downloading and subscribing to the show. Please visit the main website at miketechshow.com. You can email me questions and suggestions for future show topics. My email address is miketechshow@gmail.com. You can leave me a voicemail message. I have three voicemails lined up for tonight. The phone number is 240-949-2450, and that's Mike Tech Show, all one word, on Skype. You can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/Mike Tech Show, and follow me on Facebook, facebook.com/Mike Tech Show, and don't forget the wiki at mtswiki.com. I have lots to cover tonight. I have one question from the trenches that I need some help, and I've asked for help on this before, and it's been a long time, and I want to review this because I really need a solution. I'll get into that, and it's something I'm going to be doing on September 7th for a client with a server migration, so I need some help. And then I have the three voicemails, one great ISO app tips for techs. So we got three tips. Have a voicemail from Kevin from the chat, our moderator, who's Reliant. And have another voicemail that gets into a very complicated question about iSCSI and virtualization. I have a stack of email covering the gamut of asking questions and follow-ups to some issues and questions that other listeners have had in the past. Before we get started, you know I love Instant House Call for remote support. It's the best service. But there's a lot of features that I have not covered, and I'm going to mention two of them right now, where you can start a session direct from your website. So you can have a URL and actually use email and social media to advertise that and to make it easy for someone to click, download the client so you can connect. Instant House Call, they make it very, very easy for that. And how about this? How about accepting payments online? You get paid by your customers fast, and it integrates with PayPal or your own merchant processor to accept their payments very, very fast and easy from your customer. You can get all this by trying it out free for 15 days. Just click on the link at miketechshow.com. The Instant House Call ad on the left-hand side, click on that. And when you fill out the information for your 15-day free trial, enter the promo code MikeTechShow. And you'll be glad you did, and now you can kick the tires and try out some of these features. First, I want to ask for your assistance. Anybody who has done a domain migration, you have a server and a domain. You're bringing up a new server, and it's going to be a totally different domain name. And you have multiple workstations where you need to migrate their profile. Now, you've heard me talk and use FABS Auto Backup for Tech doing that. Is there an easier way? I know there's been some utilities and some things that people have discussed. I want to hear from the individual that has personally used a utility, a trick, something to migrate the profiles cleanly and easily. I need a solution once and for all, because I have one client that on September 7th, on a Saturday, I will be taking two servers that are on a domain and consolidating their data onto one server that I've already placed the order for, and it's a Dell PowerEdge running Windows Server 2012. I have 11 workstations that I need to migrate the profiles, and I want to do this in the most efficient way possible, and then when I'm done, I will share the process with everybody. Help me out. That would be great. Email me, miketechshow@gmail.com, and let me know what you've liked, what you've ran into, and maybe the pros and cons of using that. You know, say, hey, Mike, I've used this, but beware of so-and-so. Whatever you can do to help me out, greatly appreciate it. How about if we get started with our voicemails? This is the first one. Give a listen.
Hi, Mike. This is Corey Dowd from Port Jervis, New York. I'm here to talk to you today about a couple of iOS apps that us as computer techs can use. The first one is called FTP on the Go. This app will let you upload and download files from your FTP sites. This is very useful for us who keep files on our websites or want to upload or download something while on the iPhone. The second app is called iNet Plus. This app lets you scan subnets, and as soon as you get to a location, if you have a Wi-Fi password for that network, you can see all the connected computers and connected router model, and then you already know what model of router to look for. The third app is called File Browser Pro. This app lets you browse network shares and stream or play files or look at folders on your iPhone. These are all very nice apps, and some of them are paid, but they're useful and I like them a lot, so I will put the links in the email to the App Store for the relevant links. Have a great day and keep up the great show. I listen every week. Talk to you later. Bye.
Corey, awesome recommendation. I am going to be using all three of the apps that you have recommended. I have needs for all three of them. Now, I have been using a utility called Snap that does the network scan, and I think I bought it for like $5 a couple years ago, but I am definitely going to try all of your utilities that you've recommended. Thank you so much. Second voicemail. This is the complicated question about iSCSI and virtualization. So hang in there. This is going to get very geeky, very techy, very fast.
Hey, Mike. It's Seth from Michigan giving the call. I have a question for you and your audience about virtualization and SANs. I'm specifically focusing on Microsoft's Hyper-V 2012 virtualization and the OpenIndiana ZFS SAN. In our particular configuration, we're actually running it with a RAID Z2. Basically, it's a RAID 6. We can lose two hard drives and we still have data. Okay. So what happens if you completely saturate an iSCSI link? I guess let me explain a little bit simpler. I'm not sure on everybody's familiarity with virtualizations can get kind of complex. So to break it down, in our situation, we have two nodes, kind of like two physical servers, and one SAN, which is kind of like one external hard drive that both of the physical servers can access simultaneously. We have multiple disk pools, more or less a Windows shared volume, which are accessible by both of the physical servers. Those disk pools, kind of Windows share volumes, are mounted through iSCSI. It more or less makes the physical servers think that the disk pools are real hard drives in those physical servers. Bear in mind, this is very complex, so I'm doing my best to explain it. So feel free to elaborate after I finish my voicemail here. What happens, though, if the actual iSCSI link is saturated? So we have two nodes that are both accessing separated hard drives, SAN hard drives. What happens if we totally saturate the iSCSI link? I don't think that was the actual situation that we encountered yesterday. We still got to review the logs more today to make sure. What it looks like we actually did was we completely filled up one of the disk pools. The SAN overall had available space, but the Windows disk pool had zero available space. As soon as that happened, all of the virtual machines, which are VHDX virtual machines, those VHDX files are physically located on the SAN, not on the physical servers, because the physical servers have the Hyper-V 2012 virtualization installed on them. Now, what happens if that disk pool is completely filled on the SAN? What can you do to prevent that from happening? What if the iSCSI link or the networking interfaces are completely saturated? What can you do to prevent that? Also, as a little secondary question, looking forward into the future, right now we're working on upgrading and configuring a second cluster, which will also be running Hyper-V 2012 core. We're just looking to be able to have VMs fail over from one cluster all the way to the other cluster using like a live replication, something like that. And I'm just wondering if you or any of your listeners are familiar with that and have any tips as to where to look for that. So hopefully this question makes sense. I realize it's quite complex, so I'm hoping that either you or your listeners understand what I'm trying to explain here, and maybe somebody's got some ideas. I appreciate it. Thanks. Bye.
I understand, and I have no Hyper-V experience that you're looking for, especially to fail over clusters, but I have that experience with VMware and ESX server, and there it's a dynamite product. You can easily set triggers that based on so much percentage of usage or processors or what you need, and there's all kinds of controls. It could be networking, memory, disk space, processor, like I said, where based on those certain rules, servers will move from one cluster to another or within a farm, a server farm, that can then better utilize and the performance. You can even on the fly add processors based on the need. It's phenomenal. Getting back to your iSCSI and your flooding, you have to make sure that the network switch that you're connecting your iSCSI storage to, you have to make sure that you have all of your iSCSIs tied to VLANs that are isolated just for that traffic, and it's not commingled with the other traffic on the switch. So you need possibly better sophisticated switching technology between your storage and the servers. I need to know what that bandwidth is and what those switches are. You can email me that, and I'll try to work through that with you. But you got to make sure that you've put some money into that to guarantee that you're not going to get it the iSCSI saturated. If it's saturated, you're done. Game over. I mean, you can have all kinds of unpredictable results. I inherited a problem like that a couple years ago consulting, and it was horrible, horrible issues that all of the users were experiencing because the iSCSI was not isolated for performance. And you want to make sure, and you may already be using VLANs, I don't know. You may already have the rules set up for the switch, but it sounds like you're not allocating enough network bandwidth on your current switch to accommodate what you need for your storage. And that's what you want to look at. This is from Kevin.
Hello, Mike. This is Kevin from Akron, Ohio, otherwise known as Reliant in the chat room. I want to make a very, very important point for a piece of software that we call Crystal Disk. Yes, Crystal Disk is powerful. Crystal Disk is good for finding out what's wrong with your hard drive. But I do not use it as the end-all, be-all of all hardware diagnostic software. Case in point, I had a Seagate 500 gigabyte hard drive in here. Crystal Disk showed that it was bad. When I ran the diagnostic from the company, which is CTOLS, it short passed and long passed during those two tests that I ran. I did inform the customer to keep an eye on his hard drive, by telling him to use the crystal disk icon on his desktop. And he said, of course, that he would and would let me know. Another case in point, I had a Western Digital 1 terabyte in here. The terabyte drive showed that it was good on crystal disk, whereas the Western Digital software showed it was going bad. So I don't want nobody in our tech community to be using crystal disk as the final say in telling a customer his hard drive is bad. It could be very bad for you as your tech, as a tech for them, because if it goes bad within a week or so and you told them it was good, then you're stuck with possibly a hard drive bill to go along with the reinstalled Windows. So keep all the manufacturer websites diagnostic softwares with you on your thumb drive and you should be okay. Okay, this is Kevin. Mike, you're doing a great job. Thanks for the show.
Great advice, Kevin. You're right. Crystal Disk Info is just a quick first snapshot as to what's going on. And I like running that because it'll quickly tell me something. But you are absolutely right. You want to use the manufacturer's utilities to do a more thorough analysis and give you better results. I absolutely agree with that. I don't go to them, I think, as often as I probably should. I definitely would caution along with Kevin and heed to his warning. Thank you very much for taking the time to you and everybody for sending in your and leaving your voicemails. I really appreciate it. And it's a great way to contribute to the show, and I really like it. And I know everybody enjoys that. Now it's time for email. I want to get to this email that was sent to me over a month ago, and I don't know why I have not gotten to it. And this is from Curtis, and this is some warnings before you upgrade your customer. Hey, Mike, I have a favor to ask. I work for a company that sells large multifunction devices. They're copy, print, fax, scan, etc. These devices have the ability to scan to email as well as directories. A lot of our customers depend greatly on the scanning function of these devices. However, there have been a massive influx of customers calling and saying their scanning does not work any longer. Here is the issue. The customer's IT department or third-party consultant upgrades their email to something like Outlook 360 or Gmail or some other service. That's fine. However, these services usually require that email goes over SSL, port 465 or 587 usually. The customer might have an older device with us that does not support these functions. Or the IT person might upgrade their file server to something like Microsoft Server 2012. Great. Now they can't scan directories because Microsoft took away support for SMB2. This is no joke. We had a customer that called one day and said they can't scan the email. Turns out they upgraded their service and it now requires their email to go over SSL. Why don't they upgrade the device and your devices should support SSL and move along with the technology, especially for email? The machine they have with us is older, so it doesn't work. Now it's time to upgrade and they should upgrade their, you should upsell them. I know everybody can't afford that, but unfortunately, they got to look at the whole upgrade process and upgrade the device along with it. It's a very small office, and getting a new machine is not an option as they are not that cheap. So I set them up to scan to a directory. They were fine with that. It was not 2 days later that their IT department then upgraded them to Windows 8. Now they can't scan to a directory because SMB2 is not in Windows 8. Being a consultant, the IT person should have taken something like that in consideration and at least called us to talk about the changes. If it is something that the customer is so dependent on, please take it into consideration before you make the change. Not every machine will work with the new tech. Like I said, this has happened so much lately that it has ran me more ragged than normal. I hate being the bearer of bad news all the time, but That is all I've been doing lately. At any rate, if you would please pass this info along, that would be great. The company I work for is not in your area, of course, but I am sure I'm not the only one in this situation. Just make sure that the big copier printer scanning will be the scanner will be compatible with what you are moving to. That is absolutely sound advice, which now makes me pause as to the new server I talked about earlier in the podcast that I'm migrating to is Windows 2012. And they have one of those big copier scanners that I am now going to call the manufacturer and support for that device and make sure that we're all okay in the scanning of that. It's just one of those warnings that we should keep in mind. And not just the copier scanner. It's our job when we go into an office to understand all of the functionality of everything that they're doing for their operation. And they should give us the time to make that assessment for the proper recommendations. You must warn your client that if you don't have the time to take into and analyze all of the possible communications and the workflow for their business, and if they don't want to pay you to understand that, then they have to be prepared with incomplete decisions that you're going to be recommending. You're going to recommend a solution, and there could be issues because you don't understand every facet of the business. And that's hard to get clients to understand that. But we as techs need to make sure we're doing our due diligence to find that information out. Great example. Carrie has a client that, as we recommend new servers for them, they have these vertical applications that we have to call the software manufacturer and make sure that we can install that on server 2012. Maybe we have to install server 2008 as part of our upgrade instead of 2012 based on the response we're going to get from the software manufacturer. So we have to make sure that we're looking at all that and then run our checklist to make sure everything's going to work on the server that we are recommending. A recommendation from Mrs. Winston Wolf. And I'm so glad, thank you for sending me a link to a service that we talked about a few weeks ago. And it's called Shoeboxed, and it's for receipt scanning, where you, literally it's like you could take your shoebox of receipts, send it to them, and they scan everything into a centralized format for you. Check that out, and I will have a link to the Shoeboxed website. This is from Frank. Hi, Mike. This is in response to the needs of your professional photographer. I am pretty sure you use Synology products. Yes, I do. Have you considered their PhotoStation app? I have it running on a Synology DS413, and it works well from an iPad as a client. I have not considered that until I read your email, and that is also one of my recommendations, along with possibly looking at Lightroom, that Teresa, her voicemail last week, my meeting is tomorrow morning where I'm going to review different options for the photographer client. I'm looking forward to that tomorrow, and I'll follow up with you and let you know what they've selected. This is from Robert. Intel management engine problem. Mike, I have a Gateway DX4831 computer system. I am having problems installing the Intel management engine interface. I keep getting an error code 10 saying the device cannot start. I am running Windows 7 Home Premium 64-bit. I have updated the system to the latest BIOS. I downloaded the chipset drivers from the Gateway website. I have went to the Intel website and downloaded the latest version, and I still get the error. The system runs fine, so do I actually need it? Have you or anyone else ran into this problem? Love your show, and glad you like the computer that Carrie sent you. And did he include the handcrafted by Carrie Holzman plate on it? he didn't have the plates yet when he shipped the system, but a couple days later, he shipped me the plates, and I love it. I love having my system where it's handcrafted by Carrie. Wouldn't trade it in the world for anything else. It's running fabulous, and I know he's smiling as he hears that. Robert, I don't have an answer. I know we did a show a while back, and I was wondering what the need is for this software. I think there is a tool that will look and fix this. So anybody else that's having problems with the Intel Management Engine, let me know. Let me know what utilities or tips on resolving this problem. This is from Chris, and it's hard drive recovery. Hi, Mike. A while ago on your podcast, you mentioned a hard drive recovery service that you liked that was substantially cheaper in the case that they fail in getting things off the drive. Can you tell me who the company is? I emailed him right away. It's $300 data recovery. And I think it's $300datarecovery.com. Link will be in the show notes. I've had successful recoveries with this company. They do an excellent job, and they will not charge you if they cannot get your data back, so you have nothing to lose. This is from Robert. Hi, Mike. I have had three clients who have brought computers to me in the past. The first one was an HP all-in-one computer on HP laptop, and the other a Toshiba laptop. Each of these computers had a hard drive fail. The HP laptop and the Toshiba laptop had Windows 7, and the HP laptop had Windows Vista. None had the recovery disks. Both the HP laptop and the Toshiba laptop were purchased at Best Buy, and the customer did not want to pay Geek Squad extra money to make the recovery disks. Since the hard drives in each had failed, the recover partition was gone as well. See, that's the problem. That's why you still got to make those disks. The recovery disk costs $29 for each of these computers, which I feel is a ripoff to the customer. Sometimes the restored disks don't always work. What I ended up doing on each computer, I have used a Windows 7 DVD and a Vista DVD in the case of the HP laptop. Used the key off the key sticker. I do that all the time. Luckily, each had a key sticker. Installed the operating system and went to the manufacturer's website and downloaded the drivers. The problem I ran into was when I went to activate their copy of Windows. It would not let me activate online. So I had to call Microsoft and go through the process of going through the long set of numbers and then entering another long set of characters to activate Windows. I hear you, and I've lived that pain, and I do that all the time when I have to recover someone's crashed system. What I did after that is installed the drivers, got the system set up with all basic stuff like antivirus and Malwarebytes Pro, then make a system repair disk, burned it to a DVD, and then used Windows Backup and made a system image across multiple DVDs so that if their system ever had a hard drive failure again, it would be a piece of cake to recover. We could just boot the system repair disk and then restore the image. I do exactly what you do, Robert, only I don't burn it across multiple DVDs. I make them buy a 1 terabyte passport drive, so this way they can continue to back up their system to it and use that as their primary backup. You can make the disks yourself, but most customers don't do it. And they think that since they have a recovery partition, that they can restore from it. But when a hard drive fails, that partition is gone. My question is, have you ever had this situation like this happen before? And what did you do to resolve it? Hopefully you have a better way. Great show. Thanks for taking the time out of your busy schedule to educate us on computer business, on the computer business. Rob, you've done exactly what you're supposed to do. That's exactly what I do when you don't have those recovery disks. And you know what? I don't want the junk that those recovery disks install anyway. I don't want all of that bloatware and that PC crap software installed on the system. I do a nice fresh install, from Windows 7, where I will never restore Windows Vista. And I'll tell you what I do for that. I will restore Windows 7 based on what version that they have the key for, whether it's 32 or 64-bit. And by the way, the key works for both usually. So what I'll do is make sure that when I'm recovering, it's going to be Windows 7 64-bit, and it's either going to be the Home Premium, the Professional, or the Ultimate. I rarely see Ultimate anymore, so it's usually Pro or majority Home Premium. Now, when it comes to Vista, I refuse to put Vista back on a computer system, because if it can run Vista, guess what? It can run Windows 7, because Windows 7 actually uses less resources than Vista. So, just by the very fact that Vista's running on it, I know I can get Windows 7 running. So I will upsell them to Windows 7, and I'll get the OEM from Amazon. I will buy that, and I will convince the customer to upgrade to Windows 7. So I'll do a little upsell there and then go hunt down the drivers, which is sometimes the hardest thing. If the hard drive hasn't completely crashed, I will take it and see if I can at least read something from it, because I would love to get the drivers off it. That's always my nightmare. I'm always so happy when Windows 7 finds and installs all the drivers for the system. I go to the device manager, and when I see nothing in options, I am so happy that I don't have to go hunt down the drivers. For to me, that is the biggest time-consuming task in this whole process. Got to get the drivers. But the lesson here, if you're just a regular consumer, you get a new computer, make the recovery disks. Since you have Windows 7 or Windows 8, create that repair disk, run the backup, do a system image to an external disk, and you're happy. But the typical user does not know to do that. And that's why when you're counseling someone on buying a new computer, make sure part of that process is doing that. So here's what you do. Go help someone get a new computer. Now, I've always wondered, how do you bill for that? If you're going to just advise someone to buy a new computer, well, here's your opportunity to say, look, I'm going to give you the advice to go buy the computer. When you get it, you're going to hire me to make sure you're protected, that if anything goes wrong, we're going to be able to recover fast. So I can come out there. I'm going to help you get your recovery disks. I'll remove any crap that was installed. I'm going to set you up with free antivirus and make sure with all the free goodies that is going to really help you be more productive on your computer. And that's how you can get an hour or two of consulting time with a new client or someone that's buying a new computer. This is from Joe. Windows install without the 100 meg partition. That came up in last week's show. Hi, Mike. I install Windows 7 and Windows 8 without that reserved 100 meg partition. It is only needed if you use BitLocker. BitLocker is the encryption that comes with Windows that I do not like. I like TrueCrypt. It also houses the system recovery tools. But if you install without the partition, they are installed on your Windows system partition, so not to worry. I install this way, and he has the steps here, because that 100 meg partition can be an issue with certain imaging and cloning software, as in trying to recover an image. It is a variable that is not needed. I have done every install this way for years without issue. Here is a step-by-step instruction I have provided to accomplish this. Mike, as always, you are the best. Here's the steps. Boot from the Windows 7 or 8 DVD. Select Install Now. Accept the license terms. Select Custom Install. Select Drive Options. Delete all partitions. Select New. Enter the drive size, use all of the hard drive, select Apply. Select OK about additional partitions. Delete the larger partition, not the system reserved. Select the system reserved partition, should be smaller of the two shown. select extend. Enter the full amount of the hard drive space. Use all the megabytes available. The system reserve partition is now full size of hard drive. Select next and continue with the normal Windows 7 install. I've always wondered what the best way to get rid of that, but I was always afraid to do that because, you know, it's only 100 meg. So, well, what's it hurt? But I like this. And if you don't want to have that 100 meg reserve recovery partition that Windows insists upon installing when you do this, follow these steps from Joe and you'll be able to install without it. Joe, thank you for listing that and taking the time for that. This is from Mike. Windows 8 unidentified network error. Mike, I'm a longtime listener to your podcast. I find it very interesting, informative, and always helpful. However, I have a problem that I just cannot solve. My son recently finished assembling a new home-built PC. He did his research and purchased some pretty good equipment from Newegg for the build. For the operating system, he purchased the full install version of Windows 8 Pro. He assembled the PC in our game room and used a direct wired connection to our home network. The OS installed without incident, and he was up and running in no time. The only hitch he ran into at this point was with the Windows 8 activation. As he tried to use the internet to do this, the automated response repeatedly responded that his version was an upgrade version, not the full version. Other than that, everything worked great. He installed one or two online games and was able to play them perfectly. About 4 or 5 days later, he decided to move the new PC into his bedroom. He disconnected the Ethernet cable from his old PC and reattached it to the new PC. The new PC starts up great, Windows is working fine, but now he is unable to get attached to our home network. During a phone call with Microsoft, he was able to resolve the Windows 8 activation issue, but they had no idea how to resolve the networking issue. They had him reinstall Windows. Oh, no. But it did not fix the network problem. Oh, there's no reason to reinstall Windows. We have tried the following, but none of these have worked. Delete the network adapter from the device manager list and let it reinstall on the next boot up. Setting a static IP address on the PC. Assigning a static IP address based on the MAC address on the router. Disabled and then enabled the network adapter. Attached his PC directly to the cable modem. I am lost and don't know what to do next. A little bit of internet research seems to suggest that this is not uncommon. With some recent versions of Windows and many of the suggested remedies seem to be hit or miss. I am stumped. Do you have any idea of what I can do to fix this annoying problem? I have a suggestion. Go to one of your box stores and buy a wireless adapter that's USB. Plug it in. I know it's a desktop. And see if it gets an IP address and can get on the network. It sounds like, and I understand now why they wanted Windows 8 reinstalled. And it sounds like there's a problem with the TCP/IP stack for the wired Ethernet adapter. You can try a couple things. Disable the onboard adapter and buy an inexpensive Ethernet card, throw it in there and see if that does the trick. Try the wireless and see if that does the trick also, but you don't want to stay that way because you want to be wired over wireless. Now, because you haven't tried it and you haven't mentioned this, the tweaking.com all-in-one tool does a lot of fixes for the network adapter. Run that. You have nothing to lose. And see if after the reboot, after you've applied all of the changing the WinSock and the TCP/IP stack and everything involved in the Ethernet and the networking, pick that, let it do its thing, reboot. See if that works, because you've done everything that I would have suggested. So now we're just going to go a little further and think outside the box here. try a different Ethernet cable. I didn't hear that you did that. I seen a lot of other things. Could this be a handmade cable? Absolutely change the cable. You know, out of all the things I've recommended, do that first. Then try the software, then the wireless adapter, then another network adapter. They're the only things I can think of that you didn't list here. Mike, I am very interested in the solution to this, and hopefully it's as simple as a network cable change. I really hope so. And also, did you reset the router? That's another thing. Make sure you reboot the router. Is it a router that you have control of? Reset it to the factory defaults. So hit the reset, go back to the factory defaults, and start from scratch. So we got lots of things for you to try. Keep us posted on how you, or if you get this resolved. And I think you will. So I want to know which one of these things hopefully fixed it. That's it. If you purchase from Amazon any products, any books, movies, boy, they're the ultimate place for anything that you want. Use my Amazon.MikeNation.net to make your purchases on Amazon. Share that link. Your price is the same. A small commission comes back to help support the show. It makes a big difference. It really does. Thank you so much for your continued support and using my Amazon link. And again, that's Amazon.MikeNation.net. Thank you. That's it. I hope you enjoyed the show. Send me feedback. You can leave me a voicemail message. You can send me an email. There's lots of ways to communicate with me and the Mike Tech Show family. Follow me on Twitter. Follow me on Facebook. Thank you so much. I'll be back next week, same time, same channel. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Mike Tech Show, a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. Please visit techpodcast.com.